You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Paul.
Hello, Robert. How are you doing today?
Oh, that's what I wanted to share with you, actually.
Oh, yes?
But first, let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, editor-in-chief of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You are Paul Bloom, one of the most distinguished psychologists in the 51st state, also proprietor of the falsely modest newsletter Small Potatoes, author of many books, and a regular conversant of mine, I guess. But Paul, I gotta warn you. You know, we've had a lot of fun conversations. I think there may be people who tune in for the frivolity. I gotta warn you, I'm not in a good mood.
Really?
Here's the backstory. So I got an email from you that you wrote at 3:45 a.m. I think expressly for the purpose of bragging about your insomnia. Is that wrong?
I set an alarm to wake up so I could email you.
So
and
you
brag
could do
about
that.
Insomnia. Yes.
So you're doing this like insomnia macho thing and saying,
right.
"Well, I'll try to soldier on, you know, and I may be in a bad mood, but you know, duty calls." Now, I have a question. Did you get back to sleep?
Like a baby.
Okay.
I got off my email.
You know what?
We could actually spend time. I had really interesting dreams, but we'll put that aside.
Why don't we save that for overtime? It could be explicit content. If the things they say about you are true, your dreams could be something that we really should reserve for overtime.
Fair enough. Paying customers only.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Kind of an OnlyFans.
Kind of like an auditory OnlyFans, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But did you not get back to, did you? Like,
well, let me just say, I read your email at 4:30 a.m. Did I get back to sleep? No. And I wasn't going to bring it up because I'm not into the whole sleep deprivation macho thing, you know? But as long as you brought it up, I'm going to be in a worse mood than you. And I'm just preparing you for that. I am not in a good mood. I mean, the sleep thing itself was not itself determinative. But then I got up and looked at the news. And that pushed me over the edge. This Trump shit is out of control. But go ahead.
I have two things to say to you.
Mm-hmm.
Neither one of them, I'm sorry to say, kind. The first one is you're a meditator. You wrote this book about it. If you can't defeat insomnia, who can? What's the use of all of this if you can't control your mind enough to go to sleep? I'm sorry, that sounds terrible. Now I feel bad.
You know, first of all, it's like, why do you think I need meditation?
Yeah, fair enough.
I'm a wreck. Paul, I'm a wreck.
What would you be like without the meditation, we have to ask?
But actually, quickly, let me put in a plug for meditation. I was thinking about this the other day. Actually, I have, by and large, been getting better at getting to sleep. And it is by deploying the kinds of skills you would only have if you had meditated. I mean, it's funny. My meditation, if you ask me my meditation practice, like, how's your practice, as they say in the meditation business? And I'd like say, well, not that great. I do sit on a cushion every morning. And that's about as the most favorable thing I can say about my practice. But it is true that if you do this and you go to retreats, sometimes you can just figure out these little hacks of mind control that help you. And I have been doing like this specific sequence of things that usually help me get to sleep. But
is one of them checking the news at 4:30 in the morning?
No. And one of them is not getting an email from some guy posturing about his fucking insomnia either.
No.
Things don't help.
The second thing I want to ask you is, when you heard about Jeffrey Goldberg getting the scoop of the century, did you feel a flash of jealousy? I mean, you're a foreign policy guy, critic of the blob.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in D. Wholly's character, it could have been you that was accidentally put on that signal thing when they meant to put on another RW. That little flash of jealousy.
No.
Okay.
You know, Jeff and I are close. I always wish him the best, and I'm just happy for him.
It's the thing about you is I cannot tell sarcasm from real.
That would be sarcasm.
Really?
I will tell you, when we get to overtime,
About Iraq and other matters.
I may share some highlights of my relationship with Jeffrey Goldberg in overtime after you share your graphic and erotic dreams with us. But no, but you know why I'm really pissed? Actually, the way the Goldberg thing is played out is a little bit annoying. But the Trump thing, like, you know, as you know, I always try to find sunny side. I'm basically an upbeat, optimistic guy. People love to hang out with me because I just have this glow, as you know. So I'm going to try, even now, when I'm not in a great mood, to like summon some of that. And I guess the closest I can find to a silver lining is, yes, Trump is increasingly scary and dangerous. And I want to talk about this student from Tufts who was taken away by literally masked men from, I guess, immigration or something, who some of whom did not have identifying badges and kind of... I'll get into it. It's a creepy video. You've seen it.
I have.
I sent it to you while I wasn't getting sleep. But I guess the good news is Trump is continuing to show signs of tremendous clumsiness. And so, I mean, you know, he's not just alienating my own ideological allies. That would be a problem because there aren't enough of us to matter in his calculus. But this, like this thing he just unveiled, the 25% tariff on cars. If he sticks with that, I think that's going to make a broad swath of American car buyers unhappy in the near term. And some Canadian workers, you know, a fair number of American imported cars are made in Canadian factories and in Mexican. That was the idea of NAFTA, which Trump himself renegotiated last time around in his first term. But I don't know if he like understands it's going to raise the price significantly of all new cars bought in America, including those bought in the United States.
So run that by me again. So suppose I wanted to buy one built in the United States. Why does the tariffs on foreign cars?
Well, actually, I mean, first of all, he kind of sounds like he's going to put a tariff on parts as well.
That would do it.
And all American cars have import parts. But also, you know, the way it works is if you know, half of American cars are imported. So if those suddenly cost 25% more, then the demand for the ones made in America is going to grow, and that's going to raise the price. This is economics. It's the way it works.
I don't think the supply tariffs.
Right. The supply won't grow fast enough. There may be some slack in the factories, but So the price of all cars is going to go up. Now, hey, here's a little quiz for you. This will test your political. Is it acumen or acumen?
Oh, it's definitely acumen, I think.
Acumen?
You're asking the wrong guy.
Well, we're about to find out.
Somebody
who has any of it. What?
Somebody told me once, it's a very sort of sweet thing to say, you never make fun of somebody who mispronounces a word. Because it means they picked it up through reading. Reading is a good thing.
Okay.
You know, something I wish everybody could watch this on video because you look so contemptuous.
I do not. See, people read all this stuff.
Okay, you're gonna test my political acumen.
Yeah. So there are a lot of car companies in the world. I could list at least half a dozen that probably 8-10 that Americans routinely often buy from. There's one that should be celebrating right now because all the cars they sell in America are made in America. Guess what company that is, Paul?
Would it be owned by somebody who has an affiliation with Donald J. Trump?
Bingo.
Wow. Who would have known? Now this sounds like you were accusing them of corruption.
You're reading cynicism into, you know, basically like you're talking to Mary Poppins here. And I don't know why you see me as this kind of darker person.
Well, I got to say that Tesla is going to need a leg up because I think Elon Musk is going to make a lot of money and has been making a lot of money through his work with Doge in all sorts of corrupt ways. But Tesla is taking a hit. And Tesla is going to continue to make it because you cannot force people to buy Teslas. And people, you know, and when they see Tesla is owned as, you know, techno Hitler, they're just less likely to buy them.
Yeah. In Europe, like sales are way down, like Germany especially. Do you know what? It turns out that there are people in Germany who are kind of ambivalent about the Heil Hitler salute. Who would have guessed? But apparently that didn't go over well with German car buyers.
You know, me, years ago, I came close to buying a Tesla. The issue was electric cars, and we have sometimes we take long cross-country rides and everything. But I like the car. Whenever I take an Uber and it's a Tesla, I like the car. I think it's an attractive car. But I do not want to put money in Musk's pocket. And then there's the second order thing, which is that even if I did, I don't want people sneering at me or trying to trash my car. Bob, I'm selling my Cybertruck.
By the way, I had said I think they cost $70,000, and you'd said that high. Turns out it's higher. It's more like $80,000 to $100,000.
The Cybertruck?
But Cybertrucks, yeah.
Yeah.
The I think pickups in general are probably pricier than we might think, especially electric ones. I don't know what the Ford F-150 Lightning would run you. But what was I gonna say? Oh, what could happen though? You could get this backlash of, Trump Musk supporters buying Teslas just to compensate. Mm-hmm. The more this looks like an organized thing, which it is, there's this take down Tesla hashtag. We just had a demonstration like a few miles away at a Tesla dealer with 500 people. And then there's some actual vandalism. And so you could mobilize Tesla buyers. And so that is the backdrop for what I'm about to say. If you don't like Musk and you have a Tesla, sell it, because then you will lower the price of the average used Tesla. And for those Musk people out there who are trying to, want the badge of honor of driving a Tesla, it doesn't matter where it's new or used. And by and large, I would say this isn't a super high income group, except maybe in Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
So that, just put more used cars out there so less of the money from Musk supporters will go to Musk. Right?
You know, by doing this, by saying this, you might have put yourself in the crosshairs of an FBI task force. Because
was terrorism. That did sound kind of like terrorism, didn't
that is
it?
Terrorism. What I just said. I'm glad you now have a green card. I think you're right that people might buy Teslas to support Musk, support Trump. But there seems to be an asymmetry where somebody I don't like, I could just not buy his car. A lot of other cars. To buy a Tesla, to buy a car, very expensive car, to support somebody is, I don't think people tend to do that sort of thing.
Not to support them per se, only if it became, if you were living in a place where it really was a status symbol because it's so ideologically homogeneous and you feel so tribally about it.
Yeah, yeah. If I own Tesla stocks, I'd be selling my Tesla stocks. I think this is going to turn out badly. But you're probably wondering how this will affect the Canadian election.
That was my first question.
So as you know, we have called an election. The Prime Minister has called an election. Carney has called an election for
April. It's like a month away. It's like a month
April
away, right?
You 28th.
You guys don't screw around.
No, this is, I hate to compare countries, but the American election season lasts, 9-10 years or something, as people gear up for the election after the election. And we have a month. We have, a little bit more than a month. This is the shortest time he could do it. So he could have given more in the future. We have a month. And it's a nail biter. It's a nail biter, Bob, between the Liberals and the Conservatives.
I'm worried. I've heard this guy talk. What's his name again? It's not
Pierre
Casey.
Polyev.
What is it? No, the other guy.
Mark Carney.
Carney. He's not a gifted politician. He does not. I haven't said this to you, right? I said it to somebody on some podcast, but he doesn't. He doesn't even speak as well as the average central banker, which he's been. And they are famous for speaking unclearly. It's not that he speaks unclearly. But he doesn't speak that precisely. And in any event, it just doesn't have the punch you need for political rhetoric. He just doesn't have the sense for the, how to hit him in the gut, right? Like the way Trump does.
I think that's true. He's not a charismatic man. He's a banker.
I've seen more charismatic bankers.
And his opponent, Polyev, is charismatic. He's funny. Mm. He's fast on his feet. He has an aggressive style. He goes on podcasts. On the other hand, months ago, before Trump got elected, the conservatives were this wild favorite to win, to get a majority mm-hmm. government. Like, you know, you go into betting markets, it's 99 to 1. It's just, and I wish I went on the betting markets and I voted against it, because two things happened. Trudeau stepped down, as people expected him to do, and Carney won and seemed to be a popular choice. And Trump did his Trump thing, the 51st mm-hmm. state. And through everything, now the whole priority of our election is dealing with Trump, standing up to Trump.
Yeah, see, I'm pessimistic for a couple of reasons. I mean, about the chances of Carney, the liberal candidate. One is, I suspect the polls, if anybody on either side is lying to pollsters, I would think it would be more likely to be
the conservatives. Yeah.
Yeah. Because, you know, it's like, it seems unpatriotic to vote for him because he is perceived as having kind of connection to yeah. Trump. And because, you know, Trumpist candidates, they seem to have this thing where people, especially when they first burst on the scene in the country, people being a little reluctant to admit that they're voting for them. So I worry about that. I also worry that Trump will finally get the memo that if he wants to have the closest thing he can get in Canada to an ideological ally in power, he should really try to stay mum about the 51st state thing for just 4 weeks.
I don't know what Trump wants. Trump was in an interview with said that the issue of the Canadian electoral race came up, and Trump was like, yeah, they got a conservative guy. I hear he doesn't like me very much, so maybe the liberal guy should win. And mm-hmm. I don't know what Trump wants. Trump might want a liberal prime minister so he could then have this glorious conflict. They'll look, they're a bunch of socialists. They're the enemy.
He may. And it's true that Polyev did have to start saying unflattering things about Trump once Trump said he wanted to conquer Canada. Some of us might have predicted that, but not Trump, I guess.
Yeah. So it's a tight race. I looked at the polls this morning. They're each at like 37%. There may not be a majority government, in which case, Jagmeet Singh, the NDP leader, may play a huge role. The Bloc mm-hmm. Québécois. It's exciting. It's exciting.
It'll be interesting to see how Trump plays it. I wonder if toward the end he'll start saying, yeah, you know, I could see a tariff deal if this Polyev guy is in office.
Yeah, but think like as Trump does, this 4D chess. If Trump wants Polyev to win, he better not be saying nice things about Polyev, right? The Canadians, it would be on every ad, every political ad. You want to vote for the guy that Trump wants?
Yeah.
So it's 4D chess. Only a mind.
There's a sense in which regular chess.
There's
a sense in which regular chess is 4D chess, Paul. It takes place in a three-dimensional world, and there's also time. It takes time, so that's four. On the other hand, you're right that it only takes two dimensions to depict the chessboard, the relevant parts of the chessboard. So,
I think for Trump, it's Parcheesi. It's whatever. I think. You know, we could talk a little bit about his authenticity, but I don't think he's playing some elaborate game to get the person he wants in power. I think he's just saying, you know, this guy said bad things about him, so I'm mad at him.
Yeah. He's playing two-dimensional checkers, and that's when he's at the top of his game.
Yeah. But it's going to be exciting. I have to say, like, I'm probably going to vote liberal. I've always voted liberal, and it's where my affinities are. If Polyev won, it would not be a nightmare. This guy disagrees with Carney over fairly subtle matters. The Liberals have moved to the right regarding immigration, regarding taxes. So now a lot of their positions are indistinguishable. It's six of one. Yeah, I mean there are differences, but it's not like when Trump. It's not like the Trump-Harris difference, which is mm-hmm. enormous. This is not enormous. Mm-hmm. Particularly since it's likely that whoever wins won't have a majority government. So then there has to be some wheeling and dealing and complexities before anything gets done anyway.
Yeah, I mainly just want something that Trump will not welcome.
Hard to know what that is.
It kind of is. I mean, if the outcome gets him publicity, he'll be happy, I think. I mean, that seems to be half his game. Quickly on this, the latest... arrest of someone who, now this is not a green card holder who was detained today, but
she's on a
student visa. The video is very creepy. These guys in masks. I mean, remember, one of the Trump administration's demands of Colombia, which and of course, Colombia caved, is like no masks. Only the brown shirts get to wear masks. So they're in masks. Some of them don't have identifying badges. And they say to her, well, at least one of them says, we're the police. Now, that is, for practical purposes, a lie. In America, when you hear police, you think municipal police. These are my local law enforcement officials. And they should say, like the FBI, they say, this is the FBI. That's what you should say, is tell them what agency you're from, especially if you don't have a badge. But they say, we're the police. They sweep her away while she's screaming. You know, I mean, to her, it probably feels almost like a kidnapping. And what had she done? To the extent that anyone can tell, she apparently was not actually active in the protest in any leadership role. She did co-author an op-ed in the student newspaper. She's on a Fulbright, by the way. She's a 30-year-old on a Fulbright scholarship from Turkey. And it said two things. It said Israel had committed, had violated international law, which Israel has done. America has done. In fact, these countries are two of the several leading violators of international law in the world. And I mean that literally. So no doubt about that. And then she also called the Gaza war a genocide, she and her co-authors. This was after the International Court of Justice had said, like, officially that it was plausible that this was a genocide. So, I mean, that's like, I don't know where that is in the legal process, but it was an official determination and everybody said it mattered. The point is, this was not some wild outside the over, you know, I personally use the word genocide conservatively. I have not said it about Gaza. I have not said it about the Uyghur thing, which the State Department has said. The U.S. has designated that a genocide, but of course not Gaza. But anyway, I recognize that the term has evolved over time. It is used more loosely than originally now, both in popular discourse and in international law circles. It is not beyond the bounds of conventional usage to call this a genocide. And it certainly is not so crazy that the only explanation for it is anti-Semitism, which, remember, is the Trump's justification for this whole thing, is it's being done to fight anti-Semitism, supposedly. Which brings us to this other case. I read there's a very good column by Shadi Hamid in the Washington Post today that, first of all, it was interesting. First of all, he said there's another vibe shift. He said, you know, when Trump came in, they said there's a vibe shift. And Shadi said, yeah, he felt it. That, you know, his friends were saying, I feel freer to speak out about gender and so on with Trump in office and blah, blah, blah. He said there was that. But now he thinks there's another counter-Trump vibe shift. That may be 50% hope on his part. I don't know. I would say that the more Trump does things like radically increase the cost of cars, the more likely it is that there will be a broad-based vibe shift. Anyway, Shadi gets into this, the case of the guy at Columbia, who is a green card holder, Mahmoud Khalil, and gets into some of the details. I didn't know this, but apparently he was, to some extent, a moderating force. He refused to participate in the occupation of Hamilton Hall. He intervened, according to Shadi, when a protester shouted anti-Semitic remarks. And he said publicly, quote, there is, of course, no place for anti-Semitism. Now, this is this guy was the subject of, and he is a Syrian of Palestinian descent, but he's a green card holder. He was the subject of discussion on this somewhat famous now NPR exchange on Morning Edition, where this guy Troy Edgar was being interviewed. And they said, Michelle Martin said, so what did this guy do? And he's throwing around like terrorism, anti-Semitism. And she's like, no, but what did he actually do? And what he said was, it was embarrassing for him. He just couldn't come up with, if I said, well, he put himself in the middle of basically pro-Palestinian activity. Now, you know, the administration would have us believe that they're trying to keep us from 1930s Germany by, you know, stomping out anti-Semitism. This is 1930s Germany. When you take a term like pro-Palestinian, which means what? You like Palestinian people? You're in favor of a Palestinian state? I mean, that's not anti-Semitic. There are tons of Jews who are in favor of a Palestinian state and like Palestinian people. When you take a term like that, like pro-Palestinian, and turn it into an accusation, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sorry, that is like Hitler saying about somebody, they are a Jew lover. That is the analogy. And it's just, I mean, in a way that's, well, you should never say this. That's unfair to Hitler in the sense that there would have been more skill behind it. Hitler, like, you know, he would have thought the thing through. This guy is, I think not very smart. This Troy Edgar guy from the Homeland Security, he's the Deputy Secretary of the Homeland Security Department. Anyway, that's my rant. And I got into this mood this morning, partly for lack of sleep, partly from annoyance at you for bragging about your lack of sleep, and partly on the merits of the case. There really is some disturbing shit going on in this country.
Yeah, I agree. So a few things. One thing is, you know, I think it's not that the analogies between Trump and Hitler are kind of weak, because Hitler was never funny. And Trump is often funny. And so, you know,
Andy Bessner sent me, I guess it was a Twitter exchange or something, evidence that I had doubted that Hitler was funny. I demanded that you show us Hitler being funny or something. Danny provided what he considered examples. Anyway, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, we could discuss, is Hitler funny? Was Hitler funny?
Yeah.
Look, the case of the Turkish woman, whose name, unfortunately, I forget, is hits home because she's a developmental psychology PhD student. Mm. And so, you know, I don't know her, but I know people who work with her. And there's a lot of emails going back and forth now about what our professional organization should do about this kind of thing. And
her last name is Ozturk. Her first name is Rumeysa.
I mean, I have, I think, even a sort of a slightly different view than you. You're at pains to say what she said was not that unreasonable. It's within the Overton window. And, you know, I think if someone is actively planning terrorist activities, supporting terrorist activities, that's a different thing. But I think people should be allowed to say, including visitors to our country, absent advocating and supporting violence, whatever shit they want to say. Suppose it was really inappropriate to call this genocide. Or she calls something genocide that shouldn't have been called genocide. Every intelligent person believes it. Well, so she has an extreme view. That does not right. Compare a threat.
Well, yeah. Now, would you say flatly anti-Semitic remarks should be okay? And of course, she's not a citizen. She's not a green card holder. I don't know if that's relevant to you, but
it's a good question. I actually had a discussion with my son where we had different sizes. It's a good question. I think there's a case to be made that you would hold visitors, visa holders, green card holders, to somewhat different standards. Like, you could be a raging anti-Semite, and there's nothing the police could do to touch you in America. And that's fine. That's the way it should be, as long as you limit yourself to speech.
If you don't espouse violence.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I don't know. I actually just don't know what I think about this regarding green card holders and visa and visitors to the States. I'm not sure, but...
But my point of going into the genocide thing and the international law thing is, even their claim that there's some kind of evidence of anti-Semitism is absurd, given what she seems to have actually done. What's amazing is that with both of these people I've mentioned, like, couldn't they find somebody who did speak up in support of Hamas? Like, they haven't given us any evidence that even... I mean, there were some students doing that, and some of them must have been immigrants. I don't know.
There's a question of why they're choosing to target the people who are choosing to target.
And I think the reason is because they didn't support Hamas. They want to send the message. Yeah. I mean, this is maybe too cynical. They want to send the message that, no, strong criticism of Israel is unacceptable. That's, I think that's the message they want to send.
You know, the U.S. is changing. At least the perception of the U.S. is changing. We had a faculty meeting yesterday in Toronto. So, and there's a lot of conferences in the States, and a lot of our students are going to conferences, and we're going to conferences, and a lot of our students are not U.S. born. And so there was a discussion over what you should do and should you carry a burner phone. And I think to some extent this is hyperbolic. I think the odds of somebody going through your phone, it's just statistically very low. But there's real anxiety, and there's a lot fewer Canadians are going to the States. I think a lot fewer Europeans are going to go to the States.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you told this to Trump, he would say it's a feature, not a bug. He's entirely happy to isolate the U.S. from every other country, in part by making people afraid to come.
Yeah, and isolate, you know, through the tariffs. I mean, it's total isolation. Yeah. It's like stop the immigrants, stop, you know, significantly slow down the trade, the economic interdependence. And
invade some countries while you're
and then it. Invade. And, you know, I had a conversation with Jeet here of The Nation who drew my attention to the connection between these things, which is that, you know, if you're going to build economic walls around yourself so that you're not getting much through trade, you know, it's the old fashioned logic behind the empire in you know, old fashioned empires, like you need to own the land that has all the minerals you need because there isn't much international trade. Well, the great triumph of international trade was to make conquest unnecessary because it was actually cheaper and easier to get the stuff you need by just buying it from other countries. If you can just stay on good terms with them, then to conquer them and occupy them. And you know, as Jeet pointed out, mercantilism in that sense goes hand in hand with empire. He pointed out that Adam Smith, one reason Adam Smith liked free trade is because it made conquest unnecessary and made war less likely.
Yeah. One might say there's a historical force moving us towards increasingly non-zero-sum interactions.
Oh, man. You know what?
There's a book to be written on that.
I'm sorry. I got a quote. I just finally looked up what I thought was in my book, Non-Zero. I hate to subject you to this, Paul, but you really did walk right into my trap.
You really did
walk right into my trap.
Yeah.
So, you know, Non-Zero, it did celebrate, it pointed out things are getting more and more non-zero sum. They have ever since technology started, you know, in the sense that the web of non-zero sum just kind of expands, blah, blah, blah. Globalization is a manifestation of that. I did not say that, we're inevitably headed toward cooperation. I said we need to recognize that things are more non-zero sum. Nations are more independent. They need to respond with somewhat more in the way of international governance, blah, blah, blah. Well, we didn't, and so we're fucked. But that's not really what I'm talking about, Paul. So sometimes people with broadly my ideology who welcomed free trade are blamed for our current predicament because look where it got us. American workers got screwed in competition with foreign workers and so on. But, you know, Paul, as I thought I remembered, I had warned against this very thing. And I had a way to keep it from transpiring. I'm going to quote from my own book. I'm sorry. I apologize for this. So near the end of the book, I was talking about, like, threats to, like, globalization. And I mentioned, you know, this is before 9/11. This is like the book comes out in December of 99. I mentioned Tom Friedman's like super empowered angry man. What he meant was, you know, relatively small groups have the capacity to wreak mass violence broadly. That's a threat. And then I wrote, in addition to the super empowered angry man, I'm quoting myself, Paul, we face what you might call the quite disgruntled man, maybe not upset enough to bomb the World Trade Center. That was a reference to the earlier bombing,
yeah.
But still displeased with the drift of things. And thanks partly to information technology, able to have real effect. This category includes Americans who lose jobs to low wage foreigners, French farmers exposed to high tech competition, Their political manifestation is a reactionary nationalism with a nasty nativist undercurrent that, amid an economic downturn, could get pretty ugly. I would say that's where we are. These disgruntled men and women aren't going away. Indeed, the source of their grievance, the globalization of capital and technology broadly, is so basic as the constitute. Well, inevitability number three, that was this trope I was doing. And I get into this guy, William Ogburn, a sociologist who talked about the problem of cultural lag, you know, culture not adapting fast enough to change and advocating adapted faster. And I said, you know, there's another alternative. Just try to slow globalization down. And I said, look, obviously, you know, there's no velocity control knob. But I said, if we were aggressive in using international trade deals like NAFTA and the World Trade Organization to do environmental and labor policy in ways that would cushion American wages against the threat of foreign workers. So I called for all that and said, you know, this is like the globalization of politics and it should happen. It didn't happen. But you know the irony?
Go ahead.
And then I'll shut up. Then I'll shut up.
Oh, no.
But Trump, the first time around, actually did what I was recommending. There is a thing in the NAFTA he negotiated where there's some incentive for Mexican factories to have a minimum wage of $16, of at least $16. That's the kind of thing I meant. Like that slows, that buffers the U.S. workers from competition.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I don't know who said this, but there are no solutions, only trade-offs. And, you know, anybody who's in favor of free trade and against tariffs, anybody who's honest, will recognize that there are people who suffer for this. And you want to compassion the system trying to buffer that suffering. And it might involve slowing things down a bit in some ways.
Yeah, but I did not favor the unilateral solutions of tariffs. I favored the multilateral solutions of like using the forums for international trade, like the WTO and NAFTA, to implement policies that would keep things moving at a politically acceptable pace.
Yep. Yep. And I don't think, I mean, to give Trump his due, I don't think there's anything intrinsically wrong with using things like tariffs to slow things down, to punish other nations, to in response to grossly unfair practices regarding workers and so on. And, you know, one thing which Trump said in this debate with Harris, which was true, was that Biden kept a lot of Trump's tariffs against China. He felt that they were useful.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, so it's not intrinsically wrong. The insane way Trump is applying them is wrong.
Well, it can be smart of an intelligent part of an intelligent industrial policy in principle now. And that's what Trump is saying. He's saying this is going to make people move factories here. In the long run, it could, but in general, his approach to tariffs does not show careful strategic calculation.
Would you forgive a change of topic?
Mm-hmm. I would. Yeah, I'm sorry. I apologize for that.
No,
I want you to rant for like.
No. Five I'm not going to rant. But I was wondering if you have some time to talk about Jesus.
I'd be happy to.
Good. So you had a Ross Douthat. Douthat.
Paul.
I really have a problem with this.
I mean, I'm going to know how to pronounce this conservative candidate's name before you know how to pronounce Ross Douthat.
The Polyev of New York Times columnist. Mm-hmm. Anyway, he had been talking about his new book, Believe. And as you know, and as we talked about here, I really enjoyed the book. I had a lot of respect for it. And I found your discussion with him really enlightening, a lot of fun. I'm not a paid subscriber, so I didn't get to see the final half, but still.
Give you a comp?
I can't get access to the comp. It just doesn't show up on my podcast feed. It's okay. It's a separate issue. But it just occurred to me, you guys were discussing at one point miracles and the perception of extraordinary things happening in your life and encounters with loved ones, with dead loved ones and so on. And I have the feeling that under Ross's, let's call him Ross, his worldview, God exists. But it's a strange God. It's a strange, arbitrary God. Like at one point, I think he was talking about challenges to the view. If you mentioned that there's studies on the efficacy of prayer, I'd find nothing. And he says, yeah, but you know, the mystical forces don't like being studied. You know, sort of a Hannibal Lecter sort of thing. He thought he could put me under a magnifying glass. And yeah, that's kind of strange for a supernatural being that created the universe. When he talks about the problem of evil in his book, he points out one possible solution is God's not strong enough to keep evil things from happening. And it's just a kind of a strange God you end up with, one which is hard to fully see why it's worthy of worship. Anyway, I had to get that off my chest.
I'm not sure I'm the person you want to say this to.
That's right, because your belief, which is complicated and subtle, doesn't involve a sentient, loving being that intercedes to help the worthy and punishes the evil and requires prayer and sacrifice. You just talk about, well, your views are subtle and complex.
I mean, they're I'm kind of broadly agnostic, except to say that, oh well, who cares about me? I talked about this with Ross. I do think there's evidence, there's reason to think that there's purpose in the universe and so on. Mm-hmm. Kind of a different argument from Ross's, but you brought up the problem of evil, and I think, you know, Ross would say, well, there's two ways out of it. One is to say God can't control everything, so he's not responsible for all the suffering. And then the other, you know, the standard thing to say, the most common thing said in response to this in Christian and other religious circles is suffering is the price we pay for free will.
Yeah. But that's a terrible argument. It doesn't explain the suffering of babies and non-human animals.
What you could argue maybe is that it's the price we pay for things mattering in a certain sense. I mean, you know, if we didn't have subjective experience at all, I would say nothing would matter. I wouldn't like if you killed everybody, it wouldn't matter. If no one is having subjective experience anyway, it's just like killing robots who you assume have no consciousness. Mm-hmm. That's not considered a moral crime generally. And if you ask, well, what is it about subjective experience? You say, well, you can have delight, you can have these pleasures, you can have love. Well, all those are like positive things. And it may be, I mean, again, you could say, well, why didn't God make it otherwise? I guess, but it may be that you just can't. I mean, I don't want to start sounding like a line out of a Cameron Crowe movie, but you can't have the sweet without the bitter. I think as a metaphysical matter, that may be true of the universe, right? Like it may be, I mean, there does seem to be this like relativity built into pleasure such that you only appreciate it because it stands in contrast to this alternative state, you know?
This is true. For any individual being, it may be metaphysically impossible to have a life of pure joy and happiness. I'm not sure that that's true, but it's possible. But you wouldn't make the claim that it's a necessity. Even God couldn't work his way out, that you have concentration camps and genocides and gulags and so on. You'd imagine God could have just twiddled us. He didn't have all of those things. And the existence of those things is either an argument against the existence of God or, you know, option one. You know, God really tries his best, but even God can't beat Hitler all the time.
As they say. As the old saying goes, even God can't beat Hitler all the time.
It's a Hitler-heavy heavy podcast today.
You know, especially if it's like a joke-telling contest, right, Paul? Because as you pointed out, Hitler was a barrel of laughs.
I think
God is famous for not having. No, actually, God is famous for having a sense of humor. I guess that would explain Trump, right?
There's a couple of jokes in the Old Testament where God does that. Doesn't he show Moses his backside or something? Kind of moves Moses. Am I getting that right?
Doesn't God show Moses his backside?
Millions of people are Googling this.
This would be in the Hebrew Bible. I'm going to leave you in charge of this one, Paul.
Okay. I will. The book of Moses.
The New Testament is a very, it's like a family thing, except for Revelation. and some other things.
Is Jesus ever funny?
That's a good question. He seems a little on the somber side, I gotta say. Yeah, I guess there are no...
Wait. Google here. In Exodus 33, Moses asks to see God's glory. And God, instead of revealing his face, promises to show Moses, quote, my back parts, after passing by, protecting Moses from the full radiance of God's splendor.
Well, my back parts. That could just mean I'll be facing the other way. I think you're reading. I would worry about myself if I read into that what you seem to be reading about it. No. I would go see a therapist.
I'm gonna the backside. No, there's so much exegesis here. Anyway, this is not.
That's
this
a very
is not
a, that is a very twisted reading of scripture, Paul.
Okay, we'll see. We'll see. I'm gonna come back armed with rabbinical discourse on the topic.
Okay.
Okay, well, actually, we can talk about The White Lotus because you have not watched it yet.
No, we can't. No plot spoilers on that. Now, we probably, is it getting to be about time for overtime? Or I'm going to look through the long list of topics you sent while suffering from insomnia. And by the way, I just wanted to express my sympathy for you on that. and see if there's anything that really is just begging to be not in the overtime segment.
Season finale of Severance. Trump being
Severance is definitely overtime. Yeah. We can't talk White Lotus until I've seen it. My wife and I have exercised exemplary self-discipline. We've been saving White Lotus for the post-Severance, the Severance withdrawal. That has arrived, and we will watch our first White Lotus episode tomorrow.
We did God.
You can plug your new Substack.
You had stories of your good friend Jeffrey Goldberg.
We can talk about that in overtime. Yeah, my good friend Jeffrey Goldberg. I will say, I just the whole spectacle of that thing was so gross. Like, I mean, first of all, it's like the morning. Like, who's running this thing? It was like the morning of the attack. And you got a few guys who don't include Trump, and apparently they feel free to make the decision themselves. And Hegseth is like, oh, yeah, I could go either way. We could. You guys want to just go watch a basketball game instead of bombing this poverty-stricken country? I don't know. Whatever. And then the kind of high fives after they report that we hit the target as he was going into the building where his girlfriend lives, and the whole building collapsed. And they're like, yeah, dead girlfriend.
Well, it's not hypocrisy. They made it clear that they care very little about rules of combat, rules of engagement, and civilian casualties.
Yep. They have made it. They have made it clear.
They're not a bunch of woke snowflakes over there.
Nope. Not a problem. Not a problem in the White House. So, So I guess we will say that we're going to head into overtime. And if you're a paid subscriber to either the Non-Zero newsletter or the Small Potatoes newsletter, You can actually be with us.
Yep. And I will add that despite your insomnia, this is giving you a certain energy, but your usual charm and civility has stayed intact.
You don't mean that.
You're not the only one who could be sarcastic. No, I do mean that.
See, it's a sign of my sleeplessness that I wasn't quite sure you didn't mean it.
Subtle. It's subtle.
That's when I'm not in top form. Okay.
Lots of gossip coming.
Lots of gossip. I'm deciding even as we speak how deep I want to go down the Jeffrey Goldberg rabbit hole. Go to one of our newsletters, become a paid subscriber. You'll feel good about it. Okay. And thanks to everybody.